Hello and welcome to this bonus episode of Pulp Kitchen, a very special episode, because if you're watching the video, you'll notice that we're not in James's flat as normal. It's because we have a guest all the way from America, a touch of Tinseltown to England, a little bit of LA to London.
And you've flown just for us
today. Exactly.
For no reason.
One half of acclaimed, successful American film podcast from across the pond. Please welcome James from Raiders of the Lost podcast.
Wow, what an introduction.
Been admiring you guys from afar. Yes. Another film podcast. With a pun from a film title.
Yes. Exactly. So
how
you guys
could we not?
Got yours from Pulp Fiction, obviously.
Of course.
Yeah,
of course.
Love the title, Pulp Kitchen.
Thank
it's really
you.
Catchy.
Thank
when
you.
I told people I was doing this, what is it, like a cooking podcast?
We tried, babe. We did.
We cook up some conversation.
That's
you
it.
Do. There you go.
People feeding you film.
People thought we were an Indiana Jones specific podcast for the longest
yes.
time. So they eventually found out once we start going. But thank you for the introduction, and I'm happy to be here. Unfortunately, I did not fly out only for you guys.
Oh.
I'm in mid-production on a film that I'm ADing, assistant directing. And I decided to pop to London, obviously, for the weekend.
Amazing.
Because I've been in Reading and Liverpool and Silverstone and all over the country, but had to come see you guys. I want to be on the show because I love your show and you make great content. You guys are very charismatic and cool and fun to listen to, so I thought it'd be a good fit.
Oh, thank you.
Likewise, so we're going to interrogate you with...
Yeah, please do.
Glad you feel so welcome. We're going to interrogate you with games,
yes,
trivia.
Absolutely.
I'm kind of scared.
So if you follow us on socials, you'll know that we posted it. It might have gone out yet, we don't know, but you'll see it soon, of a video... that we recorded with James with some quick fire questions outside, just quick about film. And we are going to talk now through those questions in a slightly more long form fashion because James gives some very interesting answers.
I hope so.
So
very prepared as well.
Yeah, you
I
are.
Thought very
I've
good.
Done it before.
You really
yeah.
are a pro.
Yeah. Oh,
you really
I
are.
I appreciate it.
You should
I like
do this
being on
full
camera,
time.
Not going to lie.
Yeah, yeah.
I thrive.
Should we go through some of James's answers?
Yeah,
then?
Let's do it.
Okay, so first of all, you gave an answer to a question that really challenges something I was literally thinking about on the way here. So we asked which director has the best filmography of all time.
Tough answer.
You said maybe Kubrick. You said maybe Scorsese, did you
mm-hmm,
say?
Mm-hmm.
But you settled with, and you said Sir Ridley Scott. I like
yeah,
the way you left the knighthood in.
Absolutely. Yeah. Respect that man so much.
I find that interesting because I was thinking about him this morning and I think that I was trying to work out when was the last Ridley Scott film that I enjoyed, except for The Last Duel, actually. But
I felt so
prior
seen when
that,
you said that.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
a great movie.
Underrated movie completely. I think it kind of got lost in that kind of post-COVID
exactly.
mix. And also he had House of Gucci 2 months later, which I think got all the attention. But you hold a candle for him, do you? You champion Ridley Scott.
Sir Ridley Scott made two of my all-time favorite movies, two of my top five favorite movies with Alien and Gladiator. And I think he's just a terrific filmmaker. And this century, I still think he's made so many good movies. I mean, American Gangster.
Yeah,
that's
I've seen that
epic.
In a long time.
American Gangster's yeah. an epic. The Martian was excellent. It's
yeah.
one of the best book adaptations ever. I mean, if you've read the book, it's fantastic by Andy Weir. But that's the director, the Australian director, Andy something.
yeah.
But the movie itself is sensational. It's such great filmmaking, huge success. Made, I think, over $700 million
yeah.
at the box office.
It's really easy fun as well, that film, I thought.
Yeah. It's funny, great filmmaking. And The Last Duel, of course, Ridley with him, his filmography isn't all bangers. He has some duds. He's got a lot of hits, obviously. But I think when you have three of the best movies of all time with Blade Runner, Gladiator, and Alien, not to mention just a consistency throughout 4 or 5 decades now, it's tough to compare him to most filmmakers. I mean, Scorsese's there, but I feel like because Scorsese, for me, has never really touched on sci-fi, and he's dabbled with horror. Cape Fear is probably his only horror movie, maybe another one you could throw in there. I love Scorsese. I think he's the best director ever. But
yeah.
for filmography, I almost said Kubrick because Kubrick hit every genre, kind of like Nolan. Nolan's never really hit horror before, but Kubrick has hit every single genre. War, satire, war, horror, science fiction, pretty much everything. Plus, I love Barry Lyndon, which is just an underrated masterpiece from him. But I settled on Ridley because I just love that guy so much and so much respect for him. I still think he's got it. I can't wait for Gladiator 2.
Yeah. Oh, man, I just finished shooting Gladiator 2.
Yeah, the other
I
day.
Sort of very
yeah.
sort of boozy selfie with Paul Mescal and Ridley Scott sort of taken.
With the cigars?
Yeah, 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 yeah. But the thing is, like, so I caught some of The Martian on TV recently and, like, I liked that movie. Good fun. I agree with everything you say. My only thing was just, like, it's about a guy. I never read the book, by the way. But it's about a guy stuck on Mars and I just sometimes was like, I wanted a bit more despair. I don't know if that says something bad about me, but I was like, for a guy who's stranded on Mars, I wanted a bit
keeps
more
it
like,
very light.
But yeah, it keeps it light. And I almost, no one dies in that movie, you know?
No.
Good point.
No one
True.
Dies in that. And I think-
A rocket blows up.
Given the, the stakes are so big,
yeah.
he's kind of vlogging on Mars, being like, look at these potatoes I made. Get ready with me as
yeah.
I make some poo spuds, you know?
have you read the book? Does
yes.
he sort of self-vlog in the book?
Exactly.
Exactly
like I said, it's an amazing book to film adaptation. That and No Country for All Men, I think, might be the best ever, in my opinion. Yeah. But the character Mark Watney is really sensational. Even though no one dies in that film, it just shows perseverance. You know what I mean? The human spirit keeps us alive. And this guy, he most people would probably fail and they'd probably die on Mars and give up. But he has so much hope and just uses his skill set to survive. I think that says a lot about humanity and people. But I think it does, people don't have to die for it to be a great movie.
Of course not. Of course
there are stakes, though. There are stakes. He could die.
But yeah. On The Last Duel, like we said it so many times, but I cannot say enough how surprised I was when I saw that film and how we've said how mismarketed that film was and why I don't think it got the audience it's deserved. As soon as it started doing its thing, doing the sort of like vantage point loop, I was like, oh, this is totally not how it marketed itself. I find this way more interesting and complicated than anyone is giving it credit. And it got the trailer was weird. It was going for sort of Batfleck, Ben Affleck, and Matt Damon going in for a gladiator light.
Exactly.
It's not that film at all. It's really.
I wonder
really
if it was because of the trauma that happens at the heart of that movie. If the marketing got a little bit panicky,
we can't address this in a 90-second trailer.
Yeah, but how do we do this? Just because the film takes 2 hours to properly get to that point and break down exactly like how to discuss that properly. And I'm wondering if they just thought,
swords.
Adam Driver. Do you know what I remember from that movie, though, as well, is the accents really threw me. I don't normally complain about accents in films. I don't mind people using their own accents. That's absolutely fine. And like, I think Matt Damon has an American accent in it. That's whatever. That's fine. But his mother in it is played by Harriet Walter, British actress.
Yeah.
But she uses an American accent. I remember that. And then Alex Lawther, British actor, playing French King, used an American accent, and I'm like,
all of a sudden,
Ridley,
we're doing something with this, but not.
It's like Napoleon. They kind of everyone does their own accent, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I guess Joaquin did sort of almost the idea of an old Italian accent because Napoleon was Italian, then French. But with The Last Duel, like I think you're spot on with the marketing with this triptych storytelling. I had no idea that's what the script was going to be. No. Complex storytelling. I thought it was really brilliant.
And
but
the title, The Last Duel, I don't think lends itself at all to the subject in the film.
And then. Ben Affleck specifically, everyone loves Ben Affleck, and he's such an interesting, fun character in the movie. On the trailer, he just looks like a serious guy, but when you watch the movie, he's so light and hysterical, and one of the best parts of the movie, and you can't get that all in the trailer.
Yeah, I think, talking about Ridley then, Napoleon, what did you think?
I really enjoyed Napoleon, I honestly did, and I know not a lot of people saw it, but I think when it comes to war epics, especially period pieces, Ridley's probably the best filmmaker at it right now. Mm. He's made so many, but he just knows what he's doing. He's insanely efficient. I thought it was very funny. I enjoy history, specifically I like history about dictators, and I think the story of Napoleon is really fascinating. And obviously they took some liberties, a lot of inaccuracies, but it's like any movie. I mean, shooting a cannonball at the pyramid, a lot of historians are like, what are you doing, Ridley Scott? Ridley's like, well, how else do you show him taking Cairo or in Egypt in 5 minutes? It's a good way to do it. That's good storytelling and filmmaking for cinema. I think Joaquin's incredible, but I think focusing on the relationship between Napoleon and Ophelia was really smart because it's like 50% of the movie is that relationship. But that is because Napoleon, you could argue, is one of the most original simps of all time for dictators. But I think they did really interesting things with those two characters.
They definitely sort of painted Napoleon in, I can't say historically accurate, but like a very decisive light.
Yes.
There's elements of it I thought, okay, that's interesting to do that. But I think like you and me walked out of that going, battle scenes, amazing. Yeah, if not some of the best Ridley's ever done. Yeah. And he did three. Usually like films don't get more than one or two of those in terms of budget and scope. But he had three or even four really great battle scenes. And the history of it all was just incredible. But like the bits in between, I think we weren't like that enamored with.
I did think when I was watching some of the battle scenes, I said, when was the last time you saw a live action cavalry charge? Like with actual horses, like 100 horses wrangled. And we were just talking about trying to like...
The reset time.
For that. Okay, can we get the horses back up?
People have just run across 700 meters on a field. I was like, and cut. All right, can we just do this again? That must just be like, you get two a day.
Yeah,
surely. Makeup, hair...
That's why I love Ridley so much. I respect him. Obviously, most people in production companies would do CGI for that. But Ridley's like, no, we're going to have 100 horses charging into battle together.
You can totally tell it's real that the people are there. Or maybe, I mean, who knows? Maybe not. Maybe it wasn't. It feels very real when you're watching it.
Yeah. This talking to Ridley Scott actually is quite apt because it actually brings me to another filmmaker that you put down for another answer. So we asked you what movie makes you cry, right? And your answer that you gave outside was Manchester by the Sea. Mm-hmm. However, when I saw your notes, when I scribbled them down just now, you also wrote down Million Dollar Baby.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. And it's funny because Clint Eastwood and Ridley Scott are kind of, I think, similar in, you know, being much older. I mean, Clint's in his 90s now. But still churning out movies on a regular basis and of fairly good quality. I thought Richard Jewell was really good.
Yeah, it was a really good movie.
Um, Million Dollar Baby then, why does that movie make you cry?
Obviously, it's tragic. Yeah. I don't want to spoil it in case no one's ever seen the movie, but by the time you get to the third act of the final climactic incident of what happens to Makushla, it's really tragic. It destroys me. Like, I'm getting hair standing up just thinking about the scene. But as soon as the opening credits of that movie starts, I start to get teary-eyed, and I'll let a few squirt. But Hilary Swank's so sensational. But again, going to the human spirit and perseverance, similar to Mark Watney, the character, and the Martian, the character of Hilary Swank's character in Million Dollar Baby, just not giving up and just staying true. She's like 34 years old. She wants to be a professional boxer. She wants to be world champion. And she's on her way there until tragedy strikes. And the relationship between her and Clint Eastwood's character, the trainer, it's so incredible. It feels so real, impalpable, and authentic. And it's devastating. And I feel so much for those characters. When you feel for a character, that's when the tragedy hits you hardest. Just like in Manchester by the Sea, Casey Affleck's family, what happens to the family.
Yeah.
Because you're so in love with the character, and also it's a horrible thing. You can't just help but just be devastated for me personally.
Can I ask, we didn't ask you this question outside, but what is the most recent film that made you cry?
Oh man, that's a good question. Well, I mean, I watched Pan's Labyrinth on the first week of January. That made me cry. That movie makes me cry every time too. Yeah. Just Ophelia, and man, I love her. And that movie, that same response of when I hear the music in the opening title credits, I'm just like, oh my God, I got to hold it in right now.
Yeah.
But that movie gets me hard too.
Yeah. What about you, James? What was the last film?
Last film that made you cry? I can't remember.
Wasn't it the Pixar film, Eternal, Aflame?
Oh my God, totally. Elemental really took me by surprise. I'm watching Elemental, and I chose quite a bad time to watch it. Went with my girlfriend, and it was a bank holiday or a school holiday, and it was loads of like nannies and parents taking kids to see like the colourful film.
Yeah.
And I just thought, like, you know what I mean? When you're stuck in amongst all these other kids. And I'm watching this film, and I think it's mostly quite average, a concept that's a little bit woolly. But that film, if you've seen it, you know, it does sneak up on you. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen it.
Okay, so like the ending hit me, and I was like, I know these Pixar films sneak up on you. And me and Natalia were like, we're not going to cry. And my girlfriend Tad's like, it's not going to happen. And then like when the moment happens, we both look at each other streaming.
Oh my God.
Same with Onward. Did you see Onward?
No, I didn't see
Onward. Onward totally got me kind of average for like most of the runtime. But that touched on something I think really profound.
I feel like Onward and Elemental are like the B-side Pixar films, you know, the ones that are like the ones that
they feel like concepts that someone came up with in a meeting and were just put on ice for a while, and then they had some time off. Like, yeah, let's make that one where it's fantasy, but there are modern inflections with like smartphones and rock and roll, but it's fantasy.
Yeah, man.
I can't recommend Elemental, but watch with caution.
I will. Yeah. What's made you cry?
The most recent film to make me cry, which is out. Coming out right now in UK cinemas is All of Us Strangers with Andrew Scott.
I haven't seen it yet.
I don't know when it's coming out in the States. Maybe it might be out at the same time.
It's out on Friday for us.
You know, I saw it at the London Film Festival, and that's like really early in the morning. And I get it, a bit like you talking about Million Dollar Baby. That whole film is really, really sad. And there's one scene in it that... you could just hear it in the audience, like a tidal wave of emotion and all these sniffles. And I was like, cool, cool, cool. And then I'm just like streaming. And I'm like, yep. I will say though, actually at the end of Past Lives, I had something which I've never had before, which was like a single tear.
Same.
Single tear of wisdom.
Sad, but yeah, just like one or two
thoughtful
tears
sadness
tops,
with that film. Yeah. Makes you reflect on your own life, what you missed, what you said goodbye to.
We all have past lives. That's the thing. That's why I love that movie so much. It's top five of the year for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think it was our favorite. Yeah. A lot of people who wrote in said it was like that. Anatomy of a Fall and some others were top film of the year.
On swinging to the other side of the industry, we asked you outside, what's the best MCU film since Endgame? Bit of a tricky question because it's been a bit of a rough patch.
And it's a pointed question because I'd say unanimously the sort of post-Endgame run has been spotty. Do you think that's fair to say?
Spotty, mate.
Yeah.
And you gave a very interesting answer. You said Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. Yeah. Do you want to elaborate on why?
I think because when it comes to creativity for post-Endgame, for directors obviously getting their shot at a movie, Sam Raimi coming in and taking a horror element to it. You know, I think the third act of that movie was really strong. Didn't love the opening. It felt like it was a re-rushed reshoot, the opening sequence. It didn't sell CGI-wise. It felt like Ant-Man. When I saw Ant-Man, I'm like, this is what the first 10 minutes of Multiverse of Madness looked like. But I think once the film got going, second or third act, Sam Raimi got to really play with what he does best, with horror, creativity. That musical note sequence was really cool. I liked the skeleton zombie Doctor Strange was a lot of fun. So when Sam Raimi got to finally kick the dial to horror, rather than setting the movie up for MCU playfulness and easiness for the first half hour or so, once he got going, that movie I really enjoyed the second half of.
Mm. I think I'm in between you two because I agree with what you said, Thea, that I liked the horror inflection. At least I could see Sam Raimi in the shoot. You know, sometimes you see... We did a rundown like a couple of years ago of all the directors that have worked on these MCU films. And some of them have done fantastic projects outside mm-hmm. the MCU, but you don't sometimes see their fingerprints on it. But I could see the Raimi fingerprints. You didn't enjoy it as much.
I think that was one of the first sort of post-Endgame Marvel films where I think the concept of the multiverse started to slightly unwind for me. I agree, the visuals of it were brilliant in that very Marvel way. But I think Doctor Strange 1's visuals were also really original, like all the kaleidoscopic...
Yeah.
I don't know what you call it, when that fight between Mads Mikkelsen and Tilda Swinton, I thought was really cool in the first one. But you know what? It's just like, I never really got a good sense of what place we were meant to be and why is it important to be in this one. And then I thought the third act to me, I was like, what are we doing? Yeah. It's all a little bit much. And I think there's a couple of Marvel films where I felt overstimulated by the end.
Yeah.
But I know some people do like it. But then, like, the problem is the films that followed it, like Quantumania.
I should have prefaced by saying I have not really enjoyed many or any of the MCU movies post Endgame. Yeah. I should have prefaced it. I'm not saying that.
Best of a bad bunch.
I don't even think I enjoyed Multiverse of Madness that much.
No, sure.
But I think
sure.
objectively for me.
Did you like No Way Home?
Oh, okay. No Way Home, I loved. Yeah. But I watched it again recently, and I think it isn't as good as it was when it first came out. But also, No Way Home, it's technically a Sony movie. It's 25% Marvel Studios, 75% Sony, but it's a Sony movie because it's a Spider-Man movie. And so Sony had, that was pretty much a Sony movie from
the highs of No Way Home are genuinely some of the highs ever for me. That really does, I think, float up the entire rest of the film, which when you watch it the second time and you know what's coming and you're ready for that, it's a lot of it is naturally not that strong. Yeah. A lot of the way in which they treat the villains that I've grown up with, I'm like, that's not really... I remember Dr. Octopus or Willem Dafoe. I don't think that's the coolest thing they could have done with those characters. But I still stand by the scenes with Garfield. I think it's spoilers, but no.
The scenes
with Garfield and Tobey Maguire, genuinely amazing. The moment where Tobey Maguire like stops Tom Holland from taking revenge, totally good. For me, who's grown up with Tobey Maguire, Spider-Man, perfect.
Because, Tobey's my guy. He's my Spider-Man. I love him.
I don't disagree with anything. I never watched
the
Raimis.
No Way Home. So
Spider-Man 2 is the best one.
I don't think I've seen the first one. I watched the second one when I was sick off school when I was a kid, and then I watched the third one. I mean, Spider-Man 3. I mean,
I rewatched the trilogy in lockdown, and they hold up exactly as good as they were when they released to me.
Spider-Man 3 has an amazing first 30 minutes, but then it just goes off the rails when Harry gets amnesia, and I'm like, he should just be the main villain the whole time. It's so interesting. It would have been so badass. Like, Peter Parker fighting in just like a suit and tie was awesome in that opening scene.
Yeah.
Great dance sequence. My favorite.
Iconic
in its own way.
Absolutely. Unforgettable as well.
Okay, so moving on. We asked you what your favorite Pixar movie was outside, and you said Finding Nemo. Mm. So I'm curious to know. We all love Finding Nemo. Absolutely agree. Great choice. Finding Dory, where does that sit with you?
I have not even seen Finding Dory, to be honest. So because I love Finding Nemo so much, but I haven't seen every Pixar movie, I think. But Finding Nemo specifically for me, it just hits me so well. I click with it really well, and I think the animation's sensational because no one had ever really done anything like that when it comes to underwater.
Yeah.
And the characters are amazing. I love Toy Story, obviously, but the animation, when you go back to watch it, it's like what they thought a dog looked like. It's very 2D. It was great for the time. It's an amazing story. But I really think when they came out with like Monsters, Inc. and Finding Nori, that era of Pixar is my favorite.
Mm. Yeah. I think for me, we watched a lot of rewatched a lot of Toy Story films at Christmas, actually. And I kind of see Pixar as like many great films, but I do kind of think Toy Story is the quintessential heart of Pixar. I don't think that's unfair.
Yeah.
And I think of all of them, you know, I love the first, but I do think particularly 2 and 3, those are like some of the strongest Pixar films and strongest Toy Story films. And I think also Toy Story 2, 1999, I want to say, and Toy Story 3, 2010, they also bookend a period in which Pixar made, I think, some of their best.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Ratatouille in 2006, 2007.
Ratatouille, so good.
Wall-E, I love as well.
Yeah, I mean, some of their really distinctive Monsters, Inc. as well, ones in that time frame. But yeah, I think Toy Story for me is
I also agree Finding Nemo is a really solid chart. I remember watching Wall-E in cinemas and being like, oh, Pixar like is graduating to this sort of high concept art house. There's no lines of dialogue for the first half an hour, probably. I was like, I'm so engaged and so interested, and it all just reveals itself to you. And it's great.
Yeah.
Loved it.
There was a lot of film critics. There's one particular British film critic who like lost his mind at how brilliant Wally was, because basically the first 10 minutes is like inflected with a 1970s science fiction film called Silent Running.
Okay.
And there's it's Mark Kermode, he's a big film critic here. He was like, oh my God, it's like Silent Running. Oh, it's brilliant. Oh, it's just brilliant. I love it.
I also really like Incredibles 1.
Yeah, that's one of the best superhero movies ever.
It's really good. And there's something about it that, despite being a kid's film or a family film, it feels like a really grown-up story about an adult relationship that I felt as a kid, like watching this marriage, I felt like really privy to something I hadn't been into before as a kid watching a film. And I was like, oh, this is really interesting. And it's also a superhero film.
It's a similar dynamic with Marriage Story, where one person's like a little more successful than the other. The same thing happens to the wife and the husband.
That's a good point. Ooh, a double bill.
A double bill.
That's why I have a podcast.
Yeah. It's definitely like made by people who have been in domestic arguments and 100%. Like live with kids and you know what I mean?
Yeah, it feels like it.
Written by
it.
People who've gone through those types of things. That's good.
Okay, so one of the last questions we asked you outside was your favorite movie, obviously. A hard question. And you gave a great answer. What did you give?
The Matrix.
Of course. A classic. Yes. I mean, we're all in agreement there. The Matrix. A great movie. I want to ask you about Matrix 4.
What movie?
Exactly.
Wait, exactly. They made a fourth Matrix movie?
But this is it.
Gone and been and gone.
We've all seen it, right? We all went to see it. Yeah. And I think we felt mixed things. I think
I was excited for it.
I was ecstatic.
But I think slightly more optimistic than you were. But I think that's like, it's just been wiped. Like in Men in Black, when they wiped the memory. It's just, did that film exist now? Do you feel the same way? Like,
honestly, I felt naive thinking that it would be good. And when I look back on how I felt when I saw the trailers, I'm like, oh, this is going to be amazing. But then as the trailers got closer to the release date, I'm like, I don't think this is going to be great. And what's funny is I saw they did a re-release of the original in IMAX theaters a week before. And so I went and saw The Matrix, my favorite movie of all time, in IMAX, which was fucking awesome.
I'd love to do that.
It was an incredible experience.
I've only ever seen it on DVD. But
oh,
I'm really
man. If you see it in theaters, then at some point, check it out. And then... And that was a week before, so that got me extremely hyped to see Matrix 4.
It's probably a bad idea.
What are they doing to my favorite movie of all time? Yeah. And obviously only one of the Wachowskis was involved with the fourth film, but I don't like what they did with the film because they kind of just threw out everything about what made Neo special as a character, as this messiah, this person who dies to save the world. And then it comes to the point in Matrix 4 where it's not really that important anymore. He's not an important character, really. Mm. He's just programming or making a program and a program being kept docile in this prison. And
that makes
sense. I thought they destroyed my favorite movie of all time with it.
I really
do think. It takes away from the original. It really does. Really, I can live with 2 and 3, no problem. It's fine with me. I like Reloaded. I saw it when I was 12 and I'm like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
But obviously The Matrix is a special movie to me, so it just... made me so disappointed I pretend like it didn't exist as well.
Do you know what? It's funny. I feel the same way about Toy Story 4, which is a film I don't actually dislike. I rewatched that Christmas. Perfectly charming, perfectly fine. But I'm watching it. I'm like, you had a great trilogy. You had something good. And I like the way that ended. I don't want an ending of spoilers for Toy Story 4 where Woody's not with the gang anymore. I want to live thinking that they're all happy at Bonnie's place.
In this era that we're currently in of like endless reboots, remakes, you kind of have to get quite good at like selectively erasing memories from your favorite film franchises. So like, I'm still loving Star Wars, but I choose just not to think about The Rise of Skywalker when enjoying the Star Wars trilogy because it's better to not think about that and vice versa with like... There's so many franchises now where there are more bad movies in the IP than there are good. Like you can look at Alien, Jurassic Park, Star
Terminator.
Wars, I think Terminator. You sort of have to become quite selective over what you choose to retain in your mind when you go to watch one. But Matrix 2, I had the same thing. I went to go see that in cinema. We were too young to go and see it, but my uncle took me and my cousin. And we saw that and we thought it was amazing. We were just like karate chopping each other down the street. And it was like, it was perfect. And then I rewatched them as a teenager and they weren't that good.
But Matrix 4 makes you appreciate them more.
There was a bit of a resurgence though for love for The Matrix Reloaded in particular. Loads of people were putting clips up and like breaking down the battle scenes and genuinely like admiring the choreography and the design
cool
of it.
It really is.
Still looks really slick in a way that not a lot of films do.
And also it's like that era of filmmaking where they built like a freeway to film that
car. Like, that's incredible set piece.
Amazing now. Yeah, to think that kind of investment and time went into filming one sequence for one film per year. Yeah.
Yeah, like Lawrence Fishburne on a bus with a samurai sword.
So bad.
Yeah. Like, yes, you just do really want that.
Yeah. Did you play Enter the Matrix on PS2?
I did not play Enter the Matrix.
Oh, great. No. That filled in so much. I'm closer to Enter the Matrix than I am the two Reloaded and Revolution.
Yeah. Was it an RPG or is it a...
No, it's you like third-person
Yeah, you played as Niobe so cool. and Ghost. Who, you
oh,
know,
that's
a
bit, badass.
I know. You have like two scenes in the actual Matrix Reloaded film, but they get this whole video game.
You get to play in the chateau against the vampires, you fight eight. It is like one of my favorite games when I was a kid, and also Matrix, The Path of Neo. Just if you're deep diving on Matrix culture,
yeah, that one's not as well loved.
No,
as,
it's not. Enter the Matrix was really
what's the
good.
One they've been building with the Unreal Engine? It's an insane.
So they did an experience on Unreal Engine 5. They released like an experience to basically show, it's kind of like a tech demo to show what you can do with technology. And they created this demo going through a city where like agents are chasing you.
Yeah.
Not a game, but like sort of a
looked incredible
tech demo. It looked genuinely amazing. They walked you, you could walk around this like city street. Mm-hmm. Incredible.
Mm. So I want to ask you a question, or not a question rather, a message that we had from one of our LA listeners a while back. And I'm really sorry, Priya, that I never read this out on air, but it's getting its airtime now. So Priya works in the film industry in LA. And we were talking about what films best represent LA in terms of like architecture, it's just like built environment. She says, La La Land, I think, does give you a scope of the different parts of LA. The famous observatory scene in La La Land is literally 8 minutes from my house, but you're able to see all the way to the ocean. LA is massive and sprawling and feels like completely different cities depending on the neighborhood. But La La Land and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood add up those nice little vignettes for different slices of LA. She says, I still get teary passing our beloved cinema dome, boarded up since they went under during COVID. Very sad. Inherent Vice for West Side Beach, which takes place in Venice. Mulholland Drive and Shampoo for the canyon and the hills. Trading Day for East LA.
I was about to say, Trading Day.
All the Money in the World for the Getty Museums, and so on and so forth. Do you have any like particular affectionate spots for like movie locations in LA?
So I guess besides what you said, are there movies I can think of off the top of my head? Nightcrawler.
I was just thinking Nightcrawler.
Great LA one because a lot of that's in the valley and everyone, when you move to LA, you have like a starter apartment, a two-bedroom apartment in the valley. And that movie, I see locations everywhere when I watch it.
Drive as well?
Drive for sure. Yeah. 100% is a great LA movie. 500 Days of Summer is a great Los Angeles movie.
Right, yeah.
And I think LA is a great city for cinema. It's sort of like New York where you can, if you do it well, you can make the city a character itself. Mm. And there are a lot of different places in LA that look like different things. So you can sort of gear your specific storyline to specific areas.
Mm.
But so I love the skyscrapers and sort of the financial district and downtown area for 500 Days of Summer a lot. But also even in Training Day, there's just great shots of just urban areas of highways that look fantastic. And again, but Nightcrawler, I think, is recently maybe my favorite for using LA as an exterior sequence for a lot of stuff.
What about Ambulance by Michael Bay, which I never saw?
I haven't
but
seen
Ambulance. LA Lance, you know, that's how it was written with the LA emphasized.
I have not seen it. What was Guy Ritchie's one with Scott Eastwood? Was that.
Oh, goodness.
That's an LA movie, I'm pretty sure.
Scott Eastwood. Scott Eastwood.
He's the villain, but Jason Statham. Jason
Statham's in it.
Wrath of Man.
Oh, right, okay. No,
that
no.
movie's badass. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's really, really good. That's an LA movie, too. That looks really good.
Okay. I think somewhere I read, you know, in Drive, there's lots of great sort of drone shots, or it might be helicopter shots, of that very distinctive orange glow of the streetlights.
Yes.
And that's very something very distinctive LA. But I read somewhere that that's... those bulbs are basically being phased out to go for LED, which means that that distinctive orange kind of look is kind of becoming more, it's going to make LA look more faceless from the air. It's such a niche thing to spot, but like the kind of warm LA glow.
So, James, thank you so much for joining us for this bonus episode. That I really like just sort of getting to know you as a film fan and like debating all sorts of different things. For all of our listeners who want to check out your podcast, tell everyone all about Raiders of the Lost Podcast.
Thanks for having me, first of all, James and George. You can find Raiders of the Lost Podcast everywhere. So easy to find. You can search us on Google, but we're on Apple, Spotify, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter. It's hard to not find us. I host it with my twin brother, Anthony. That's like our niches. We're identical twins. We've loved film our whole lives, and we started a podcast in 2020, and it's blossomed into an amazing career and get to have cool experiences like meeting these guys in London, Mike. So I'm super excited, but thank you guys for having me on.
Spot on. Well
Spot
done.
On. But it's been a blast. Thanks so much.
No worries. Thank you. No worries. And remember, guys, we post regular episodes every single Wednesday. Stay tuned for that. And have a great week. Farewell. Say goodbye, everyone.